welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 130, The Buddha's Enlightenment.
So, what shall we talk about? Shall we? How many? Everybody here knows, I presume, the Four Noble Truths. Buddha's Four Noble Truths. Everybody, who? How many people know and can recite the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha's primary teaching? Oh, not that many. Don't be frightened. I'm not going to make a quiz, but even if I did, there's no grade. I don't have any. I can't submit the grade to Governor Jerry Brown. I wouldn't mind, but I wonder if he had to do the quiz, if he could remember. He might, actually. Dear old Jerry, you're so lucky to have Jerry Brown trying to instill a little bit of sanity in our government. And so then I think we should a little bit talk about them. Actually, the word truth about them is not wrong, but it sort of puts them in a different context. The four Arya Satyas, as they are called. And Arya means noble in Sanskrit. And Buddha redefined what noble meant. But if you call them the four noble facts, it sort of makes it seem like, whoa, that doesn't sound religious. And that's one of my points today that I want to make to you. You know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, my beloved friend and teacher, he always makes a big fuss when he talks in America or Europe or in a place that does not have a Buddhist cultural background to it. And he says that he wants people to know for sure that he's not trying to make them into Buddhists. And it's not that he doesn't like Buddhism himself. He says he does. He likes it. He thinks Buddhism is nice. And it's the best thing for him, he says. But he thinks that in this time in history that people should stick with their own culturally inculcated religious tradition. And he sort of puts it with your grandmother's tradition. You should stick with that. And then learn from other traditions. And then, but what you learn, you incorporate within the cultural matrix that you're born with or something like that. He goes through a kind of rap like that. It makes quite a fuss about it. It used to irritate me a little bit, but I agree with him. I do agree with him. But then, if I happen to be there when he does that, he'll sort of, if he happens to catch sight of me, he'll look at me and say, well, some people can't help themselves. So they just, you know, whatever. They weren't particularly good as Christians or secularists or whatever they were, so they like being Buddhist. But that's a very important thing, and he has told the Pope, several popes, three popes he's met. He's told Archbishop of Canterbury, he's told every minister, he's told Muslim mullahs, he's told Hindu swamis and things, everyone he can find. He thinks it's time in history not to be converting each other and to be struggling. Religion should not be struggling for market share. This nice lady is looking for a chair. Has anybody got a blank, empty seat next to them? Oh, there's one up here toward the front. These guys, they're ready for you. That's very nice. And thank you. And welcome. Thank you. And so he said, you know, we should stop this market share thing, you know. And I think it relates to, I think I finally am getting his point. And I was at a conference not long ago where I was on a religious panel with a bunch of sort of religious leaders. And I always tell people who invite me to that sort of thing, I'm not a religious leader. I'm just a professor or whatever. And then they say, no, you are. And they put me on the panel. So then it was my chance to talk. And this was a conference about the brokenness of institutions, brokenness of leadership, brokenness of governments worldwide, brokenness of corporation, brokenness of, you know, everything's broken, right? And then, so the Ramais and the Mullah, there was a Muslim, Hindu, you know, rabbis, mullahs, some minister, a Jain guy, and they were all, you know, talking like they had some kind of religion that was doing something useful, which is why they are, it's good. But then I just got contrary feeling since I was last to talk, and I said, well, I think it's our turn to say, since we're being perceived here as spiritual people or religious people, that they're all broken. And teachings of the great masters of humanity are in any way broken. They're hardly used, actually. They're not at all broken. But the institutions that have grown up around them are broken. And then that led me to think, to saying that, because I was in that kind of, you know, a little bit business atmosphere in this conference, I said, the fact is that these world religious traditions are service industries. They're there to provide services to people, and that's why the ones that have lasted have provided a service. But what happens as institutions, they forget that they are service industries, and they're the servants of the people, that Buddha and Jesus and these people were the servants of people, not the masters of them. We go on about master this and master that, you know. And they're servants, and when they forget that, they think they own their inherent adherents, and they're somehow supposed to boss you around, you know, and they're supposed to collect dues, and like otherwise to condemn you, and this and that way, and then they behave badly, and they break themselves, you know, and they don't serve the people, you know, I think. So by your being interested in meditation, because you're inside, this is Insight LA, and Insight, actually, insight is not meditation, it's the result of meditation. But anyway, insight in this country coming from the Burmese Vipassana tradition, and the translating of Vipassana is insight. You're not necessarily having to sign up for a religion, which is good. And you're able to receive the service of a tradition that has helped people to come to a better understanding about themselves, about the way their mind works, about the way life works, about what their purpose in life might be, what they are, which is actually, where did you learn what you are and what the purpose of your life is and what you are, you know? You didn't actually learn it in church, really, unless you were some pretty old-fashioned sort of fundamentalist group. But you learned it in your science classes, actually, which is what the fundamentalists are freaking out about around the world, in that sense that they finally woke up to the fact that the scientists are the ones who are supposedly aware of the nature of reality, or they're supposed to be seeking to understand the nature of reality, and therefore people assume they have discovered something about the nature of reality, and therefore you go to chemistry class and physics class and, I don't know, electricity class or biology class or whatever other class, and there's you're being formed, your idea of what is real is being formed. And in America, and in most modern elite, little bit educated members of society, what you learn there and you come to think of as realistic is matter over mind. You learn materialism as a worldview, actually. Even the Dalai Lama, I think, always considers secular humanism as like a world religion. And his rough estimate is about 1 billion adherents are of secular humanism. And some just secularism isn't that humanistic. But anyway, secularism. And he considers that a world religion. And when people talk to him about, let's have a world religion conference, something, he always says, you have to invite the secularists. And he recently wrote a book called Beyond Religion about secular, what he calls secular ethics. Because he knows that the planet to survive requires an ethical revolution. People have to start internalizing and acting ethically even when they don't have to. Because otherwise, you know, people cannot enforce on people laws and rules when they want to act lawlessly and they say they feel they should, you know, like, you know, those polls where they go to businessmen in our country, bankers and stuff, and they say, well, if you could cheat and make a lot of money for your Goldman Sachs or your Morgan Center, would you do so? And half of them said yes in a poll. Definitely, they said, I'd have to or I'd lose my job. Half of them said, and then probably another 40% on top of that just were cleverly not saying. And maybe 10% generally would not break any rule or law. Maybe. In order to make money. And so he wants to find an ethic that people can take as a secular, for secular reason, that but that would work, and they would internalize that, and they would observe altruistic rules and would be not harm, which would mean not harming others and trying to be of help to them and benefit to them without being caught. In other words, without fearing, not only for the reason of fearing being caught, but for the reason of that's the way to do it, you know. So how he was thinking about that anyway. So this reality sense is what dominates our life. And within that reality sense, we pick a purpose of life. Because we are all realistic beings in our common sense thing. Not one of you is going to go out in the middle of one of these freeways to meditate. Because that is not a commonsensical thing to do. You know, you'll be run over or they'll come and arrest you so the traffic can keep flowing. And it's just not the thing to do. You know. So we are all common sense beings. And so we are living a life according to what our view of reality is. And our view of reality, therefore, is something that we should be investigating ourselves. We should not be leaving that to people at MIT or Caltech or whatever and assume that they have it together, which we do, but we shouldn't be, because you have to know for yourself. We are beginning to discover people are beginning to ask doctors why. They're beginning to ask companies why. They want to ask politicians why. They want to ask why. And they should. And not just passively assume that experts know everything, because they're beginning to realize that experts may know more than them about something, but they often have vested interests. And they often are not necessarily capable of understanding what we really need. We have to use our own sense and we have to be reinforced in the idea that our own good sense can help us to find out what to do. We are beginning to learn that, I think, as a whole. But it's hard for us when we're faced with an expert, you know, faced with a crisis situation. So. The four noble facts that the Buddha gave were not the founding dogma of a religious institution, basically. They were his diagnosis of life, of what your story is about our lives as human beings. And the first fact is that if we are not enlightened, which he didn't say that to us thinking that we couldn't become enlightened. In other words, his definition of enlightenment wasn't so extreme that he didn't think we were all capable of it. Human beings are capable of that. So therefore, when he said, if you're not enlightened, you're going to have a frustrating time, you're going to suffer, he would only say a thing like that if you thought people were capable of becoming enlightened. Right? Otherwise, what's the point? If you think that, and I bet everybody here, don't most of you here think that you can't be really enlightened? You cannot be, don't you think? Come on, honestly say, yes, you go meditate to feel a little better. You go, you learn something to have a little greater skill and feel so forth. But you sort of think, and you meet somebody and they say, somebody else says, oh, that person is enlightened. And you think, well, I mean, maybe. You know, whatever. For a while there, we were thinking, well, if they came from Japan and they had a certain kind of costume, or Tibet, they have a lama. Oh, reincarnation, they must be. But then we hear about disaster and catastrophe after catastrophe. And we realize that they're human, all too human. And then this reconfirms the idea that nobody is enlightened, and especially us. And we go around saying, I'm not enlightened. Right? We think when someone says, I'm not enlightened, we feel, oh, that's really great. I can feel relaxed with them now. Because that means that we know we're not enlightened. Right? So in a way, by us not being enlightened, then we don't really have responsibility for for we may make wrong choices, we'd make errors. We just, you know, we all go around. We're human. I'm just human. I'm human. Well, yeah, okay. I sold that guy like an instrument of packaged mortgages of a bunch of shacks on the beach in Fukushima as a grade AAA triple rated bond thing. But, you know, I didn't really know what it was. I'm not enlightened. So it's a kind of excuse. But anyway, Buddha, first thing was a diagnosis. If you're not enlightened, based on him, he wouldn't have announced this to people if he didn't think they could become enlightened. He says, if you're not enlightened, then you're that means you don't know what you are and you don't know what your world you're in is really about. And therefore, you're going to have a frustrating time because you're going to be like wandering like a blind person in the freeway. So that's not even a genius statement. It's like an obvious statement. If you don't know what's going on, you're going to have a hard time. Right? Very simple. Although, he said, it's a fact for an Arya, meaning a noble person. And he had a special definition of noble. Noble means someone who has a degree of altruistic perception. Not just a moralistic attitude about altruism, but an altruistic perception. Who therefore perceives the life pulse of others as equal to their own in importance and in reality. And by that definition, actually, I have to say it right away, guys, I'm sorry, women are automatically more noble than men. I'm sorry. I apologize for that to the men, sort of. But the reason is that biologically they have this experience, and even if they, for whatever reason, decide not to have any children, they have this biological thing of that their own body can become a condo. Who they never even met. An unguarded moment of passion. Oh, this difference of self and other. It's a difference of self and other. Whether or not they go through the childbirth thing. If you have lateral perception, the guys are kind of like going straight. You know, that's why they like to drive, you know, so much. And like one of those horses with the, you know the joke. You know that joke, don't you, about them to fertilize an egg? Don't you know the joke? It's context. Well, you know, there are literally millions of them, right? They go and they find one of them finally fertilizes the egg. But why? Because they don't like to stop to ask for directions. You don't know that one? I like that one. Oh, come on, dear. Go over and ask at the gas station. No, I know I'm going. That's the thing. I'm sorry. I know it's completely irreverent. And that's not the right thing to do. I know. It's a serious talk. Okay. So I'm sorry. So the thing is, so now the second noble truth then, noble fact. So by saying noble, he knows for a very unnoble person, ordinary person, very, very self-centered person, in other words, that means, they're not going to agree that it's a fact that ordinary life is suffering because they have moments of relief, they have moments of pleasure and pain, so it's not all suffering, so they won't agree with that, so it's not a fact for them. That's why he called it a noble fact. It's a fact for a noble person, but not for an ordinary person, unenlightened person. So then there's a cause of that unenlightenment is the second noble truth. What's the cause? And the cause is precisely that element of self-centeredness, which is not it's not that the people are immoral, unenlightened people are immoral. It isn't that. They can be quite moral. It's that by following rules. But it is that the unenlightened person thinks that I'm the one. Like Neo in the Matrix, you know. But they, and, you know, like we might, many of us here, be thinking that this is our event. We came here, we came in, we're like over here. We are the main person here. If you came late and you're sitting in the back, you might be a little bit discontented with that. And because somebody else, and then each person is the main person here, we think, right? Don't we? So at least we're supposed to look out for number one, be responsible about whatever, you know. We might not be super, we might be after you, have a chair, have a seat, but in our behavior, but still we have a perception that we're the center of the place. And then actually the Buddha said we're all a little bit psycho. he's like a psychologist way before these guys, in the sense that we think there's an identity that we have. We're sort of wired to think that we have an identity that is a really fixed, rigid thing that really doesn't change. That's the real us. Like a point. And we associate that with a point of subjectivity in our awareness, when at least when we're awake, and that we think is always the same. So when I remember what happened to you when I was 16 or 30 or 40, it's the same person was there. There's something that's the same that was there when I was 30 and 20 and whatever. Now I'm 72. But there was, it's always the same. And that feeling that we're always the same connects to an imagination that we have that there is a core essence in ourselves that never changes also, and that's really indistinguishably ours. So this is just a perceptual thing, the way we're wired. It's nothing negative in a way. It's just the way we are. And it's an error, actually, from the Buddha's psychological point of view. But that based on that error, we feel, therefore, there's this like inviolate absoluteness about the self, about ourselves. And therefore, when we are in normal state, we are other concerned and other considerate, and we're nice. But when something happens or we're gripped by powerful emotion, lust or hatred or envy or pride or delusion of some kind, we will be crazy. People say we will be crazy. Why? Because we'll act as if we're not in a good relationship with whatever we interact with. We will act like we're an absolute because that emotion seems to hold us by an absolute place where we just have to do whatever that is. We just can't question ourselves. Do you follow me? So that whole set of complexes is a little bit psycho. It's in the sense of a psychotic is a person who is delusional about the reality that they're in. And so I'm sorry, I know it sounds rude a little bit, but we might all be a bit psycho. And of course, if any of you have ever lost your temper, all your friends said you were psycho at that time, for sure. Or you became really obsessed with something. You weren't angry, but you had to have this or that, you know, and you become a little crazy and ruthless about it, you know. So that's the cause. And the reason Buddha announced that is that what he understood, what he had come to understand, and what thousands and millions of Buddhist therapists and practitioners and so forth through history understood, and also many people in other cultures and in other religions also understood this. It's not only that some Buddhists understood it, but the Buddhists, maybe as psychological scientists, and the Hindus especially, I think Buddhists and Hindus, particularly people from India, because it was a very advanced culture in ancient time in Eurasia, most advanced in Eurasia. So they invented the yoga, you know, they invented the best psychologies of ancient time, no question. Even Bertrand Russell admitted it, who was a Brit, you know. And they were exploiting the Indians, you know, but he admitted that in their classical philosophy. And so point is, he did this because he feels it's very it's curable. We can deal with it. We can rise out of this situation. And then he gave a prognosis. The third noble truth is a prognosis that is a very hopeful one and very surprising, and nobody believes it, really. And it's the prognosis that you can be free of suffering, really free of suffering, not just temporarily have a relief, a bit of pleasure, which won't last, and then you, from some external event or some success or something, that you have some acquisition or something, or relationship, but that just from within, from knowing your own true nature, you can have perfect freedom from suffering. He taught that, and he manifested himself, and many people realized it in his own time, and subsequently many people have realized that, and probably some of you here, if you've been inciting away for some time, have realized it. But maybe not. But there are degrees, and maybe that you can. You're going further, I guess. You can go further. So that's the prognosis is very, very good, and it. The prognosis is what makes that thing we meditated on at the beginning. How precious you are as a being. The prognosis connects with your humanity, because the way the Buddhists understand your humanity is you are not very hardwired at all. You're taught in our somewhat, unfortunately, culturally, slightly militaristic society, coming from our colonialist, Euro-American colonialist past, you're taught that you're hardwired and you gotta get it and you gotta do it and you know, like, there's nothing you can do about it. And if you don't do it, they're gonna come and do it to you, et cetera. And that's how you're taxed. That's how you pay taxes to support the Pentagon. etc. Because you believe that. But the Buddhist view is the human being is completely malleable in their wiring. Any human being can become a saint. Any human being can become quite evil and very, very difficult if they go in the dark side. And all degrees in between. And actually, every human being is constantly changing all the time. And if you don't become more conscious about how you change and what changes things and what influences you and how it is and choose what you allow to influence you using your intelligent discrimination, then you will probably be changed for the worse. For example, America today, I think, what is this statistic? Maybe, I don't know exactly, one of you will know, but American people, something like, as a mass, maybe not people here in California who do meditating, but as a mass, American people watch television something like between 8 and in normal families. That TV is on between 8 and 4. And that TV is a meditation. Anybody who's watching that, they're meditating on in that TV is your car, you know, special, whatever, hybrid like that, hybrid. But they don't advertise them that much. Oh, is that like one that much? The cosmetics are not that good. They're not that good. Your food is not that good. That 14 hours a day, although supposedly you tune out the commercials, and you're holding arches, and you want to buy new clothes, and you try to check out of the grocery store because kind of like flashed in their brain all this candy. So you're meditating complete dissatisfaction and discontent on purpose. Your brain is sent into that. It's a guided meditation, very sophisticated, and you're meditating that. And then the news, you're meditating on fear and paranoia. And the hurricane is coming, and the troops are coming. The Russians used to be coming. I think the Russians are all swimming in a bottle of vodka now. But except for Putin is trying to do something. But now maybe the Chinese, maybe who knows who's coming? Somebody. The Democrats are coming, or the Obama is coming. Obamacare is coming. Whatever it is. So that's. It's not a question whether you're going to meditate or not. It's a question of what you're going to meditate on. And unfortunately, we used to have a media that was a little bit informative, but it's pretty propaganda-ish nowadays, pretty much. On purpose, you know, because of manipulated. So you're not doing that, but you're... So third noble truth. Anyway, prognosis is if you expose your mind to the positive. If you reinforce in your mind what is positive and you deconstruct what is negative, you de-reinforce what is negative, your mind can improve enormously by baby steps every day of your life. Every minute can be better than the previous minute. And you will be better and better, and you will feel better and better, and you will. Other people will like you more and more, and it will be a total virtuous cycle, your life. And then getting to that prognosis, the therapy, that's the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path meditation, formal meditation of that Eightfold Path is at the end, actually, of the Eightfold Path. That's something you should, that's very, the Eightfold Path is like a whole curriculum of a university. It should be the curriculum of our universities. It should be the core curriculum of all our liberal educating universities, 100%. And the first of them, we talked about a little bit in regard to how precious you think you are. The first of them is what is real versus what is unreal. Realistic worldview. Are you just a brain being carried around on top of a skeleton in between Halloweens, rattling around in there, producing hopefully a lot of dopamine to go and make you feel better without any malevolent drugs? Hopefully that's what you are. Are you that? Are you merely a brain? Is your life really meaningless ultimately? Does nobody really care about it? Should you, therefore, realistically speaking, not really care about it, except for what you can get out of this or that pleasure? You know, do you have a purpose? How happy can you be? That's even up for a question. I think most people don't think they can really be that happy. They feel wisdom is a kind of resignation to carrying your misery with nobility. Right? Just kind of stagger around and like have the occasional glass of resveratrol smuggled into some 8-proof wine. And be healthy. The resveratrol is making me healthy. That's good. And you know, of course I don't enjoy being at the office that much. Of course I don't enjoy taking out the garbage. Of course I don't enjoy this. Occasionally we did enjoy once, didn't we, dear? And maybe we go on vacation, we'll have a moment of enjoyment. But then if you, a person you live with, they come home one day to you and they say, I'm so happy, I could die. Well, why? I don't know. I'm just really happy. And how are you going to react? Are you going to say, that's great? No way. You're going to say, what did you drink? What did you take? What have you done wrong? When are you going to crash on my floor? And like, and if you, they finally convince you that they're not manic and they're not this and they're not that, they're not drugged, then you're going to be equally upset like, well, how could you have left me out of it? So even the idea of nirvana, that you can be perfectly happy, like, sure, give me a break. And that's why Buddha was so smart. It's not just America either, it's ancient India. Buddha was so smart in this earlier teaching, his sort of foundational ground-level teaching, not really earlier historically the way that Sri Lanka people tell you, but it's foundational. For the people, less capable people, he was careful not to really say nirvana is bliss. And, you know, he would just say, well, nirvana is freedom from suffering. It's the end of suffering. He didn't really say bliss that much. He did now and then, but not all the time. Just said end of suffering and let people think, what might that be? Probably knowing that the more psycho among them would just think it was kind of an annihilation. Because anesthesia, you know. And that was more sensible to them. They would be less skeptical about that, he knew, than if he immediately announced that reality really is bliss, which actually was a big grin on his face. If you notice the grin on Buddha's face, if you ever checked it out, Buddha's smile, big grin. He's very cheerful, Buddha. He's very happy. Because it's a strange thing, supposedly, what the Buddha, when it's more fully described in more technical Buddhist manuals, when you become a Buddha, you have a weird experience first where you seem to disappear and everything else seems to disappear simultaneously. So it's like the space metaphor or the emptiness metaphor seems useful. But on the other hand, emptiness is not a thing either, you know. So the disappearance disappears. It's apparently what happens. And then everything is back. But it's now back where it's all transparent. At first, maybe it comes back where it again seems as if the disappearance was an exceptional experience and it goes back and forth. And that's a little dangerous thing. There's a bunch of people, have you noticed yet in your experience with Buddhists, that there's a bunch of people who run around saying, I experienced emptiness. It all disappeared. And now I'm enlightened. Have you ever experienced people like that? They disappeared. So they think they're enlightened. And then when they appear back, they're kind of a pain in the neck, actually. Because they think they're special. And you can just tell them anytime you want, listen, buddy, I disappear every night. I just close my eyes and get on the pillow and bam, I'm gone, I'm unconscious. The only problem I have with it is it doesn't last that long. The alarm goes off in the morning and I wake up. And then I'm back here struggling with it. And so great, you disappeared, but what else? You know, or like that Saturday Night Live skit where that person comes in and says, I'm Jesus, I want to see so-and-so. And he says, okay, you're Jesus. And? Remember that one? Yeah, but I'm Jesus, I'm the Son of God. And? Yeah, you're the Son of God. And? So okay, you experience emptiness. And? Actually, nobody ever experiences emptiness. Because emptiness is the relational nature, nothing but the relational nature of everything. There's no non-empty thing. There's no thing that is not empty of any non-relational essence, is what emptiness means. So all this fullness is emptiness in that sense. There's nothing about you that is not related to everything else. Everything is entangled in the universe. It's what emptiness means. It means entanglement. So nobody really experiences it. But there is a disappearing experience that's very important. But more important than that is the reappearing experience. Because the sort of the relief of everything disappearing and the sort of ontological impossible situation of you versus the universe. When you think you're the absolute, second noble truth this is, and the universe is opposed to you, as it fundamentally is, when you feel that it fundamentally is, then you will lose that opposition, of course, right? Like each person here is the main person, and each person is paranoid in this room, because every person here knows that nobody else thinks they're the main person. So they go around hiding, well, I don't really think I'm main, I care about you. They try to persuade each other of that. And they hide the fact that they think they're the main person here as they grow up, you know. Occasionally it comes out, you know. And then people are surprised, you know. But that's the unenlightened thing. So but the main thing is that you're not supposed to just think you don't exist. Okay, so the Four Eightfold Truth, yes, Eightfold Path. So realistic worldview. The people who tell you you're nothing, if there's one takeaway I always want any people I talk to have, is you are not nothing. And not only are you not nothing, you never will succeed to be nothing. How many of you really realize that? I don't think so. How many of you are afraid of nothing? Have you been tipped off? Seriously. Oh, one hand way in the back. Nobody here is afraid of nothingness? No? That's my trick question. I'm not defeated. But how many of you believe that at death you will become extinct and you will have no further existence? Okay. That's a few hands. But then you're not afraid of that condition? Now we're getting a couple of hands. There's a couple of hands. Not much, though. Well, usually, Californians are way ahead. Usually, I get a lot of hands saying, I'm really afraid of nothingness. And they're all people, of course, who believe that when they die, they're going to be nothing. Which is what you're assured is the case by, like, Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Steven Pinker, blah, 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 all these so-called science writers. They all assure you that this is known. I mean, all that old soul stuff that Jonathan Edwards laid on you and all those preachers, that's just primitive superstition. Sam Harris, you know, neuroscientists. I had one guy who was a neuroscientist once tell me that he'd seen a brain, a dead brain, and there was no life in it. He knew there was nothing, there was no person in that brain, no consciousness in that brain. He was sure of it. And I said, well, we don't say that that a dead brain has a consciousness in it. But nobody ever said that. It's a big deal. But he was very excited about it. He said, we've discovered that. We know that. Now, but I want to ask you this. Those of you who believe that and don't believe that, let me ask you one question. These scientists analyze the world. Their job is to try to find what's real, right? They're smashing atoms. They got down into dark matter and dark energy, and then they were really scared of that. 96% of dark matter and dark energy, they're very scared of it. It was discovered by a woman physicist in Cambridge, and they're upset about it. They're mostly male physicists. And the dark energy is 96% of the energy in the dark matter. So then they were very happy last summer they discovered the Higgs boson. And the Higgs boson makes them think that they have volume, you know, and they're really here. They're not going to be swallowed up in the dark energy. It's such a psychodrama that they have, these people. But my point is this. They analyze everything, and then when you analyze everything and you don't find anything, it all dissolves. You know, you smash the atom, you take everything apart, and finally, there's no core thing in it, you know. It all comes apart. And what do you have left? Nothing, right? But can you say you discovered nothing when that happens? In other words, you don't have anything you were looking for, but do you have nothing? No, right? Everybody gets that, don't you? You didn't find nothing. You weren't looking for nothing. You weren't so stupid as to look for nothing, right? You were looking for something, and then you didn't find it. So then you can say, I got nothing. But then you think that's a scientific discovery? Are these people sane? We discovered that you're going to be nothing. Your brain makes you think you're something temporarily, bleep, 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 and then suddenly you discover that you're nothing? And we that's a discovery, and that's a fact, and we now are teaching this, and you should believe it? On what grounds are you believing that? When you held up your hand, those people I'm asking you, you said you believe you're going to be nothing after you die. What are you believing in? That is the ultimate, I insist, you really reflect deeply and take the challenge that you're guilty of the ultimate blind faith. Blind faith means a faith which you could not possibly have any reason for. And even some theologians act like belief in God is like that, but you should do it. Actually, that's another joke. You know that joke? That's the joke about the preacher in the Midwest who challenged the congregation. They said, hey, I want to know here, is anybody here going to be able to define for me faith? What is faith? I want to know. Can you tell me, folks, you are solid believers, here you are, but tell me, what is your faith? Nobody held up their hand. Little Johnny in the front row is there. He's got his hand up like this. So then he says, now, aren't you all embarrassed? Little Johnny thinks he knows what faith is, and you don't know what faith is? Nobody holds up their hand. Then he says, okay, little Johnny, you know what faith is? Hey, I do, preacher. Yes, I do. Okay, little Johnny, tell these good people what faith is. He says, well, faith, preacher, what I learned, faith is believing what you know ain't true. That was told to me by Langdon Gilkey, great Chicago theologian. A joke. Okay, so that's blind faith. Okay? Now, if you have blind faith that something can be nothing, and you now know that you are something, that you can't deny that you're something. Whatever caused you the way to be the something the way you are something. Your consciousness is something. It reacts to things. It interacts with them. You speak. You do things. It makes you move your limbs. It's something. And so there's the second law of thermodynamics. No energy in the universe can ever be obliterated. It can only can be diffused in entropy, but it's never destroyed. And in a way, it's beginningless. It's never created either. You know, for material energies, the scientists have noticed that there's no way in nature of pointing to something coming from nothing or something going into nothing. They know that. But yet they insist that your consciousness becomes nothing when your brain stops functioning. But they have to be insisting that on the basis of no evidence. That's all I have to say about it. If you want to be an evidence-based person, and you believe that, you are being self-contradictory. That's all I can say. It's much more logical for you to expect to continue. Like when you fall asleep, you greet with open arms unconsciousness, obliteration of your worrying day-to-day, be here all day, take care of business consciousness. And then you will wake up in a dream. You will have a dream, and then you'll wake up. And those things will happen. So you even can go into a seeming state of unconsciousness and arise again, meaning that there was an energy continuum going on through the state of unconsciousness because it rises again in either a dream or the waking state. And yet there's going to be a final, just by dying, there's going to be a final where it'll just be asleep forever, restful lawn cemeteries waiting for your ashes and so on. And it'll be a big rest, but you're not resting for anything. You don't exist. Supposedly. So I'm just pointing out that is very, very irrational. That reduces your life to meaninglessness. It is an imprisoning worldview in that you have no reason, ultimate reason, you have a relative reason, but no ultimate reason to really develop yourself spiritually, to try to really become something special. Because how special can you get in one life and then you die? And then you're nothing. So then if you worked hard to develop yourself and if you did nothing to develop yourself, you end up in the same place. If you were really good or really bad, you end up in the same place, which is nowhere. And it was all meaningless. And even you become like a mass. You blow up the entire world. You wreck the entire planet and kill every single living being on it. Once they're all dead and you're dead, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What kind of a planet, what kind of societies will be run with that as the dominant reality view, I ask you? Will they be responsible societies? Will they be ones that will turn back from global warming, climate change, obvious complete disruption of the human environment and the animal environment? It will be one that will not do that. We will say, oh, I do worry about my grandchildren, but I'm going to keep driving my car. I'm going to keep turning on my power switch. I don't care what produces that power. Fukushima? Well, that happened to the Japanese. I can still build 10 of them in my backyard. Because they're clean. I even see an environmentalist saying nuclear energy is clean. It's the most selfish kind of hiding the waste for hundreds of thousands of years. That will. In what language will you write danger radioactive over the spent fuel, you know? Anyway, I'm sorry. I shouldn't rant and rave about that. I know. But I'm just saying, I just want you to know that you won't be nothing. Whatever you're meditating on now, you'll be meditating after you die. So you better get good at your meditating. Because actually the deeper, most subtle levels of your mind, where you have a basic predisposition, not an absolute one, but a basic one through cultivated habit of being open, generous, altruistic, loving, noble, empathetic, kind, and happy, and detached, and able to let go. If your inner core habit is like that, it can only be better and better. Life will just be better. It'll reward you. It will be wonderful. If you let your inner thing go into paranoia, anger, annoyance, self-centeredness, fear of other people, stinginess, not letting go, clutching on, trying to control everything, and tightening and tightening and tightening the knot in the core of your being, if you live like that, then after you die, you will look for embodiments that reflect that. You know, the B-52 bomber pilot who identified with his plane would be reborn as a dragonfly. Because he will like that form. The Rambo will be reborn as like a giant gorilla or something, you know. Sylvester Stallone as a gorilla. You know, you will gravitate towards a form. Human being is a weird form. We have no scales. We have no claws. We don't have teeth except in Hollywood vampire movies. We don't have poison fangs. We are not that strong or big. We're very fragile, really. And yet we're very interactive. Each one of us was taken care of as a helpless infant for a decade until we reached 13 and we told the parents, this is my life, get out of here. But actually, we needed their help until we were about 40. And so we all depend on the kindness of strangers. We're just incredible creatures. And therefore, we took birth in a very vulnerable, open-hearted kind of being that's very sensitive, though, so we're very capable of tremendous pleasure. The human brain is not at all redundant the way neuroscientists think. They think it's redundant because you don't need this big brain to stay on the right turn-off of the throughway. But that's what they think human beings are for, driving on the throughway. But to experience bliss and joy, you need all your brain. The brain is like amazing when it's infused with true bliss. And when it's aware of the actual cellular level, your health actually is your bliss. None of you who are healthy do not have bliss in yourselves. It's the bliss that holds you together as an entity. You know, it's that cohesive, delicious energy that makes one cell like the next cell. Otherwise, the cells would say, like, forget you. Like, and your microbiome would explode in your stomach. It would be the end of you if your cells weren't happy. If you eat the wrong food for too long and you, like, mess with them, they will not like it. And then they'll get weird. No, they will. So you better be happy. You better work on being happy. Inside LA, if you learn to meditate, and you learn to watch your mind, non-judgmentally at first they teach, but the Buddhists don't go on forever with non-judgmentally. Once you really become aware of your dark side and your light side and all your different things, and then you begin to reinforce the light side, the bright side, and you begin to diminish the dark side. bit by bit, baby step, tiny bit by bit by bit. You make huge, make little progress bit by bit. Never think that I'm going to go for a 3-month meditation and then I'll be enlightened afterwards, because then you'll be one of those people who leave the meditation center with a great anger and annoyance saying, it didn't work. Because it's a long cumulative thing. You've been meditating TV and commercials for decades, many of you. And that it's formed you in certain ways. And you, to make a new choice of things to meditate. And there's a few good things in TV that nature shows, you know, PBS, you know. The corporation is trying to shut it down like mad, but they're still there. So there are some good things. There's some good meditation on there. It's not all bad. But, so realistic worldview. And your realistic worldview is that you're here forever. And you have to be concerned not just with your old age and your pension. You have to be concerned with your next life. And the way to be concerned for your next life is to invest now in your mind and get your mind open and clear, practice generosity, meditate generosity, and practice generosity. Give something to somebody, a little bit, especially something you like. That's the best kind, that you already like, and you give it away. Don't overdo it. Don't give it. Don't push so far past your sort of habit that you then, every time you see that other person with that thing you gave, you get mad. Oh, why did I give them that thing? So don't overdo it. Baby steps, little by little, bit by bit, you know. Like, share your mousse au chocolat. Don't take the last 3 bites, you know. Have the first 3 bites and just give, et cetera, you know. Don't give the whole thing away and then watch the other person eat it with annoyance. And that's the first thing, okay? Then once you have that realistic worldview and you realize you are a precious continuum of good energy dragging still along behind you some bad energy, and your job is, as a human, you have this unique opportunity to really increase the good exponentially and really decrease the bad exponentially, which you wouldn't have if you were a Australian badger. Like if you saw that nature show, you know. Or if you were a bee in a beehive. And you've been a badger and a bee and a bear. We all have been dinosaurs and everything. You don't have to just go to like Steven Spielberg movie. We've all been all of those things. And we didn't enjoy them that much. You know? When you had a tail and so forth, you couldn't sit and meditate. It was like really uncomfortable. So that's the first thing. Then you have the realistic motivation. Then from realistic motion, you have what is called realistic terminal evolutionary action. Karmanta. In realistic karma, that means. Karma doesn't just mean any act. It means an evolutionary act, meaning an act that you do with a certain intention, and because of your mind is involved in it, it will change your shape of your life. You know, what you do changes the way you are, not just what you do physically, what you do verbally and what you do mentally will change the mode of your life. So you want to only do that which will change your life and your mind and stuff for the better. And what you discover when realistic karma is that realistic evolutionary action is that the mind causes change, and therefore you have to gain leverage over your mind. And that's why that thing about counting your breath and watching the thoughts and learning to dismount from a thought train that's taking you off somewhere, which you normally you just get distracted and you go off in that reverie, because the thought that is thinking comes to you in your own voice. It says, well, now what did they do to me yesterday? So you think it's you, and it takes you right out of where you are, and you become a split being where the thought has taken you off. And when this mindfulness practice that they teach you inside LA is so valuable for you, because what you learn is, because you have to come back to count your breath, is you can get off that thought train. This begins to give you a kind of choice of what you think about by inside your mind. You're not just a victim of brooding over something. You know, somebody was mean to me, and then you brood and brood, and you can't get out of that cycle of brooding, which will lead to being depressed and freaked out. Instead, there is a part of your mind that you feel brooding. Well, why did they say that? Going like this. And then the one that you learn in Inside LA will say, well, I'm not going to listen to that anymore. They were unpleasant yesterday, but forget them. I'm going to have a happy time today. I'm going to do something else. You can switch. I always like to say it's like you get a clicker for your mind. If otherwise you have to follow everywhere where your mind leads you, you're just a victim of thoughts that are put in there by conditioning that you have no control over. So you're just a victim of your environment. You don't have any freedom in your mind. So when your mind tells you, like, oh, he said that to me, I have to get freaked out, I'm going to punch him one, you just have to do it because you can't sit back and say, well, why should I do that? What good is that going to do? That's not going to help. You know, your more intelligent mind comes and intervenes and you have a dialogue inside yourself. That's not a sign of dementia. That's a sign of waking up. When you're just you're like a television set that thinks it's only Fox News. With no clicker, you're doomed. You're really doomed. You might as well just sell your soul to Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes right away. Seriously. Or NBC, for that matter, or MSNBC. It doesn't matter. Any one thing. With your clicker, you have freedom. You can decide what you're going to watch, or you can turn it off. And that's what you're out for in your mind. When you realize that your mind is karma, your mind is the deepest and most powerful engine of your evolution. And then realistic speech is next. And you speech should be only truthful. It should be only peacemaking. It should be only gentle. And it should be only meaningful. And babbling meaninglessly or harshly or untruthfully or to make people enemies with each other, you know, like puts them against each other thinking that you'll get a benefit out of that or something. Those kind of speech are really negative evolutionary action and very powerful, because speech is very powerful because in speech the human being has the ability to share minds. When you listen to someone, they have the privilege of being in your mind temporarily, and they should not abuse that privilege by talking rot. And meaninglessly, they should try to help your mind. And when you speak, you shouldn't invade other people's mind and speak a bunch of nonsense and rot and lies to them and distort them even more than they're already distorted. It's really a very severe, speech is a magnificent thing. Just because speech doesn't finally describe reality, and there's this kind of idea of the silent sage, doesn't mean that speech is not really important in giving clues and directions and pointers toward reality. You know, the finger pointing at the moon is not the moon, but it is the finger that points at the moon. And the speech is like that's very, very important. The Buddhists are really into speech. They revere the word 100%. And so realistic speech. Then realistic livelihood, number 5. You shouldn't have a profession where you're doing something harmful to anybody. You shouldn't own things and companies that do harmful things to people. You should only have a livelihood which benefits people, and because you get an evolutionary impact from it otherwise. And that's very important. You know, they're particularly down on weapon makers and butchers and alcohol distributors, you know, drug pushers of various kinds, as far as negative livelihood goes. And then but you can figure that out for yourself. That's a realistic livelihood. And then then 6 is realistic creativity. And this is where you get out of your laziness. You become really creative when you realize that you have to do something about your life and your mind, that no one else can do it for you. What was one? I love that about Buddha. Buddha's like, oh, wow, I'm enlightened. I'm so cool. I'm enlightened. And I now I'm happy because I see you can become enlightened, but I can't make you enlightened. You have to understand your own state. You can do that. I see that. But you have to do it yourself. I can't understand yourself for you. You have to understand yourself. Faith alone will not make you enlightened. Understanding makes you enlightened. And you have to have that understanding. So that's why Buddha's big job was to found a school, really not a religion, but a school, teaching. We're in a schoolroom. This is the right place to be. And it's not just schools to make you have a profession to produce things. It's a school to make you evolve. So you produce yourself in a future world, and you are able to do things for other beings and produce their happiness by being a loving being in them in a future world. That's what it's about, to really be effectively a loving being. Loving means you wish the happiness of the beloved. But what the question is, what is the art of helping them be happy? That's quite a task. And that's what you become when you become enlightened, right? So then realistic creativity means never take no for an answer. Never give up. The environmental crisis is caused because we all believe we can't do anything about it. Deep down, I know people, even their Sierra Club volunteers, and they're like really working on it. But deep down, they're like, which is good that they're still working somehow, but because it makes them feel better. But they're not. The intensity is not enough because people feel there's nothing we can do. People feel disempowered as individuals. Look in your own mind. Don't you feel? How can I change all of this? It really seems overwhelming to us, doesn't it? I do too. Me too. Emotionally. Intellectually, I know that we can. Intellectually, I know that we must. And intellectually, I'm sure that we will. But emotionally, I don't feel that way. Emotionally, I've given up. We emotionally give up the government. We think it's hopeless. Boy, they're all bad. They're all idiots. They all sell out. They don't represent us. They don't do what makes us happy. So then why vote even? So we sometimes have elections where less than 50% of the population votes. So we get worse and worse governments, actually. In Sweden, my wife is Swedish. She's dual citizen, but she's also Swedish. She proudly tells me that 96% of the electorate turn out every election. Simply because they have a regulation, I think it relates to their taxes and driver's licenses and things, so they just all vote. And they have better governments. You know, they have like daycare centers and this and that. They're not perfect. They have a few crazy people. But they basically have a better government because everybody has a say, you know. You know, that we don't turn it out, you know. And the people who are nicer are the ones who get more disgusted. Then they don't vote. Then the worser ones vote. And then we know what we get. We get some real crazies in there. Like, get the government's hands off my Medicare people. That's the kind of people we get. So then there's realistic mindfulness. Finally, we got to mindfulness. After creativity, mindfulness. And mindfulness is, you know that, because you're inside LA. And that really means becoming self-aware in a different way. And it doesn't just mean when you're meditating. It also means, you know, to be more self-conscious of yourself when you're interacting with people. Like, for example, there's a famous compassion meditation known as the exchange of self and other, where you, as you meet people or something, you develop the ability to look at yourself through their eyes. You know, you engage in a little sort of fantasy where you see how you look to them. And it's really very brilliant because it says that when an ordinary egocentric person meets another one, and we all have a little ordinary egocentrism, we measure each other, right? You know how people look each other up and down, not quite like dogs, but sort of. And then, you know, you see someone and they feel maybe a little better than you in some way, and you feel a little envy. They feel like equal with you in some way. You feel a little competitive. They somehow feel a little lesser than you. You feel a little condescending. So then, you know, this is just not normal. People are like that. You know, it's like normal, the unenlightened normal person. So then when you meet people, you imagine if you feel a certain way, that they feel the opposite way about you. So if you feel condescending, if you're honest with yourself and you feel a little condescending, you meet some sort of somebody, and then you realize they're feeling a little jealous of you. Then you do an exercise where you think of yourself through the eyes of envy, looking, in other words, at your weaknesses and your weak points, and also seeing any kind of obnoxious way you might behave condescendingly. You know, like, for example, if you ever give a beggar a dollar or a dime or a quarter, you're like, oh, you don't want to touch them. How do you act to them when you give it? And, of course, they know, they're looking at you like, oh, he's got a dollar to give me, you know. And how do you look to them? And do you do it in a respectful way? Do you still respect them as human beings, even though they need your dollar, or they think they do anyway, or your quarter or something? How do you deal with that, you know? And this kind of increasing, or if you meet someone who's like, you meet the president, or you meet a celebrity or something, and then you, oh, you know, like that. And yet, we're quite quick to see the flaws in our celebrities. We idolize them in one way, and then the way we immediately, oh, they're not so great. Oh. Immediately, that's the envy side. And then look at ourselves through their eyes of condescension. Mindfulness can, in other words, can be used that way too, where you, at first, it'll make you feel self-conscious, and afterwards, it'll make you a much nicer person, actually, and more compassionate and more empathetic and sensitive to other people. really brilliant type of use of it. That's an extension of that. But the groundwork of it is counting 1 to 10, counting your breath, looking there at yourself. The loving kindness thing is also nice, and cultivating those positive things are wonderful. But the real groundwork is to become aware, observe of how your mind works inside, how your thoughts link together, and find the gaps in those links, and learn to interfere with ones that are going in the wrong direction, and to empower the ones that are going in the right direction eventually. At first, you just want to see what's happening, right? That's realistic mindfulness. And then finally, the last of them all is the true meditation one, which is realistic samadhi, and which is concentrated one-pointed meditation. And that is the last of the Eightfold Path. So in other words, you shouldn't do heavy meditation, really intense, shutting your mind onto one point until you know which point to shut it down on. If you take your ignorance and become concentrated on it, you will become more magnificently ignorant. So that's really very important, unfortunately. There's a lot to learn. So in a way, ultimately, it's like a school. Buddhism is like a school, and it's like has many courses, and you're there open to take. You don't have to be Buddhist, and you don't have to become Buddhist either. You'll be a better Christian or Jew or secularist or whatever you will if you study from those courses. And of course, Buddhists should study other courses. You know, Dalai Lama is always sending his monks off to Christian monasteries to study how those monks do this and that, and nuns do this and that. He particularly likes the Catholic nuns who run hospitals and do good works like that. He thinks that the Buddhists don't do enough of that, and he likes that very, very much. You need to learn that. So I think I talked a little long.